Hello, everybody. Welcome to the latest and greatest episode of Inside the Hexagon. I am your host, as always, Phil Lanides, and I want to thank you for taking the time to join us for today's show. On the episode today, we have got George Santiago, UFC veteran, Sengoku middleweight champion, and the winner of the Strike Force One Night Four Men Enter One Man Survives middleweight tournament that we discussed on last week's episode. We have a great chat. It's really, really in-depth. We get into George's preparation for that one-night tournament, and that kind of actually evolves into more of a conversation about the psyche and the mentality of a fighter, how they deal with losing, how they deal with kind of marketing themselves, developing a personality, and how to, you know, again, kind of market themselves through that, their pressures that come along with that. So it's a really, really interesting discussion that I think you're going to enjoy. I did want to mention we had some audio issues. I did my best to kind of edit those out, but you will hear a little bit of an echo here and there. Also, there's some cussing, so I bleep those out for our listeners that don't like that. But it's a really great conversation. I don't think any of that will take away from the content, which is the most important part. So I hope that you will enjoy it. But without further ado, let's get to it. All right, on the line with us, we have longtime UFC Sengoku Strikeforce veteran, a great coach, a great fighter, George Santiago. Thanks for joining us on the show today.
Thank you, Phil. Thanks for having me. My pleasure.
Yeah, it's an honor to have you. So let's jump right in. I want to go over just a little bit of your early career before we get into what we really want to talk about, which is the One Night Strikeforce tournament that you won. So your early career, you had your first UFC run, but before that, you debuted in MMA in 2002. You fought in some regional promotions such as King of the Cage. You got a put together an 11-5 record, fought some really tough fighters, including Joey Villasenor, Manny Gamburian, Derek Noble, and Diego Sanchez. Then you make your UFC debut, you knock out Justin Levens, but then deal with some difficult losses to Chris Leben and Alan Belcher. What did you feel like you learned from your first run in the UFC? I mean, a big jump into, you know, the big time from some of these regional promotions. What did you feel like you learned from your time the first time around?
Man, I'm still feeling like I'm learning through the years. I mean, obviously, when we started, I was young, and I came from a small town in Brazil and made all the way to here to America. I had an opportunity to come here and start being a professional fighter. And from what my experience was, like, everything was so new to me, and I was just a talent kid. My professor, that's how he always saw me growing up as a fighter, as a jiu-jitsu practitioner. And the first few fights, it was just going with the flow, enjoying the American life, enjoying the dream, and until it hit me hard with the reality, and I had to work to get back in the game, and that's what it was, you know. I was just having fun. I wasn't training professionally the way I was supposed to be training, and after the loss in UFC for I think it was Alan Belcher, it clicked a lot of things in my life. Even I had my first daughter. My wife was pregnant by that time. Then I made a choice to be a professional, take everything seriously, and I'm glad I bounced it back and I had a good run.
Well, there's no doubt that that type of experience, especially having a daughter, that'll straighten you up real quick, make you get real serious. Well, after leaving the UFC, you get a couple of very solid wins over Andre Semenov and Jeremy Horn. And then you get an invitation to a one-night middleweight tournament in Strikeforce. So let's talk about that and dive into that. What was it like preparing physically for a one-night tournament where if it goes well, you fight twice? Is it just double cardio? What do you do from a physical standpoint? And especially, and we'll get into this in a second, you didn't know who your first-round opponent was going to be. You didn't know who you would end up fighting. So how did you prepare physically for the potential for two fights? Just is it a lot of extra cardio, or is there something else to it?
To be very honest, you said it. I didn't know who was going to fight, and plus at the backstage they changed my opponent. That's something people didn't know about it. Yeah, but I mean, I was coming from the camp, which was when I fought in Russia, the Bulldog fight. The organization had a USA against Russia. I fought in a card with a lot of good fighters and Emelianenko Fedor. We made this trip together with Eddie Alvarez. And I mean, that was the point I had to change my life, being a professional. And the first time, I didn't care about who was going to fight. I understood they brought me into Russia to lose. So I didn't give a f***. And I did everything I was supposed to do to win the fight. And right after, I had the opportunity to fight this the four-man tournament. I had no idea. I didn't change anything. And matter of fact, I was about to walk out, and I was doing defending high kicks. That's funny, because I was defending high kicks because I was supposed to fight Yuki Sasaki.
Yeah, Yuki Sasaki, right.
Yeah, I was doing a different game plan, and some guy came in for someone corner came in, like he said, look, why are you defending kick? He's going to shoot your legs. I was like, what are you talking about? They changed. So Benji Radic,
Benji Radic.
Yeah. So he was me with coaching me together that night. He looked at me. I look at his face. I was like, I think we saw each other's eyes, and he was like, okay, who gives a shit, right? So let's do fly knee. And that's what it was. And honestly, I was hoping to win the fight as fast as I could, because I don't want to stay 10 minutes and come back and do 10 more. And that was, you know, I just followed the plan that I had in my head. I saw the guy ducking, and I just flew for the high knee and connected, you know.
So it wasn't so much that I got to get a lot of extra cardio, and it was trained to finish the fight, as the first fight especially, as quickly as possible so you can get to the second fight.
Actually, I was saving more energy for the second fight, not making too much mistake, not getting hurt. That was something I had in my mind. But as soon as I stepped on the cage, I was like, it doesn't matter. It's a fight, it's a fight. Either I'm going to lose or win in 10 minutes. So that I'm always thinking of, like, I should finish this fight as fast as I can so I can get fresh for the next one. So there's nothing you can do. It's more mental than anything, I think, you know. It's okay. We're training, we do camps, we all ready to fight 25 minutes in line. Everybody, you know, if a professional fighter, you're supposed to be ready to fight 25 minutes. That's your goal, being a champion of the weight division. So it's more mentally than anything else.
Okay, and that's a great segue, because I did want to talk about training for a turn. Again, you know who the combatants are going to be, although, like you said, one of them ended up getting switched out, which we'll get to. But from a mental perspective, not knowing who you're going to fight until, you know, the weigh-ins in your camp, I assume that you just, you know, what a lot of fighters say is like, I just train my game, I don't worry about my opponent. I assume that's what you end up having to do, or is there something different?
In my opinion, all fighters are supposed to do that. Train your game, train your best, but you got to train every day. You can't train as just what you like to train, you know. You're going to have to make some sacrifice and make some extra hours, but that's what it takes. You know, you want to be the best of the best. You want to be the champion, right? You're going to have to train. And that's what I see from the most guys that are on the top of the chain. They do. They never go out of their game. They always try to push their qualities a little bit higher, the standards they have, but we have to train for everything. We need to know a little bit, at least for ground, at least a little bit of takedown, wrestling, you know, and kickboxing, striking, and that's no other way. You know, you never know. You know, you two fights of the title or finish your career. You know, all fighters know that. You know, if you lose two fights, you're out. If you win two fights, maybe you get a title shot. And that's the worst thing, not being ready for opportunity when it comes, you know.
Yeah, this is totally, and I'm, you know, not a fighter or anything like that, but one of the things that would, I think, would drive me crazy is that, you know, it, obviously pro wrestling is, you know, scripted and all that stuff, totally different, but you're working, you know, 3-4 nights a week when there's not a pandemic going on. You know, with fighting, with whether it's boxing or it's kickboxing or it's MMA, you know, if you're busy, you're fighting three times a year, and so if you lose one of those, it's going to be a few months before you get back in the cage. And, you know, I'm sure that gnaws at you and you think, how far did I set back my career? and all that stuff. So I this isn't part of my, you know, my questions, but how do you kind of, how do you deal with that? Knowing, man, I just lost one and you just got to get back in there as quickly as possible to try to get that back. Like, how do you deal with that from a mental perspective?
It's tough. You know, I that's one of the, my biggest challenge when I was a fighter, you know, because if you started, when I started watching fights, and I was a big fan of Japanese MMA, and that was my dream come to going to US, to Japan and fight. And no matter what, they recognize the fighter, you know, as a professional, as a way of living. And if you fight, you give everything, you come back. But the way it is right now is about, you know, if you're boring, you know, bring you back. If you don't deliver the service, you won't be called again, you know. But it's a tough thing. If you decide to be in for long term, no matter what, you need to win. You need to have a character to sell it, of course, but it's always tough. And I see a lot of fighters getting locked on that conception. You know, they worry so much about being the character. It will sell it, make them more money, right, and forgetting about training, getting stuck on that person. And some others just living for win. They need to win no matter what. Every day, every session, every practice, every fight, no matter what. And it's sad because the way they treat the fighters right now, it's kind of the way it is. You know, there's so many competitions, so many people wants to fight. If you don't win, you lose, you out.
Right.
But you know what I mean?
Yeah.
You gotta do what you gotta do, right? It's a tough situation now for the sport. I'm very sad the way it's taking, where it's taking everybody, being someone else they're not meant to be, and even more, I think it's narrow the chances for the person. And when I had a chance to be a head coach from Black Zealous, and I saw that, and speaking with the management, speaking the UFC, Joe Silva himself, what they want is not what we used to be.
Right.
You know what I mean?
Yeah.
We want to win fights. We want to be the best. No. Now you need to look good. Now you need to speak good English. You need to be, you need to have a lot of followers, you know, and you have to win the fight in the best way you can. You need to impress.
Yeah.
it's not, I was talking to a neighbor who is not as big of an MMA fan as he used to be. And he said part of it is because he feels like guys fight more defensively than they used to, because they know that if they lose, I mean, you get cut after one loss. And so they worry about that. But you also, like you said, you have to have the marketability for that. You have to have the personality. If you can talk a lot of smack, you know, you can get by even if you lose. I mean, just ask Conor McGregor. You can get by even if you lose because you have that marketability, you have the followers and all that stuff. But eventually you're going to have to back it up. But if all you do is win, but you don't do it, you know, looking good, or you don't have a personality or anything like that, they want the whole package if you're really going to make it to the top. And that's a lot of pressure. That is a lot of pressure on guys. So I, you know, being an outsider, not part of it, I still can understand exactly what you mean. And that's a tough spot to be in. No question about
it. It's a tough spot. That really tough spot. And the pro wrestling, I'm a fan of pro wrestling. I mean, I don't follow all the fighters, but I like, it's the way it meant to be. Everybody understands, you know, that's the way it is. You got to be an actor. You got to know, you need to know how to grappling, to do wrestling. It's amazing. I think it was still a new sport, and they tried to make this new category about what you're supposed to be as a fighter. Win is not everything right now, but if you're not the guy who wins every fight, you better be Conor McGregor, you know, Floyd Mayweather. You gotta back it up. You gotta talk Nate Diaz, you know. And it's sad because I saw a lot of good fighters, you know, making their retirement by being forced to be someone they're not. Mm-hmm. You know, even stay away for a little bit. Anthony Johnson, know, Rambo Johnson. He was out. He last two fights with DC, I was there. He didn't lose because DC beat him. No, DC beat him, but he wasn't even there. I was doing his coach in the whole camp. The first one, after the first one, I'm like, bro, I'm out. If you keep walking with people, you're walking, dealing with you're dealing with it, it's a lot of pressure from outside to be this person, you know? And it's sad because even that I thought some of them, if they were themselves, they would sell them more. You know what I mean?
Right.
Be yourself, yeah. Be tug, be whatever, be from the street, do your talk, smack, do the way you do it. Because I make the best advice, man, right now, don't try, if you start being a fighter, train everything, be yourself. If it sticks, you should know right away. If you don't waste your time anymore. Go somewhere else.
Be authentic.
Be authentic. Be yourself.
Yeah. And people see that. People definitely see through that. If you know, eventually, if it's a persona and it's not based or, you know, if it's not based in reality, I mean, you know, they say the best pro wrestlers are the guys that from a personality standpoint, that's who they are, but they've turned up the volume. That's the, you know, the phrase that's used. So yeah, be who you are. And because if not, they're going to see through that eventually. So that's why when guys talk about, you know, guys like Colby Covington and McGregor and guys like that, to me, that maybe the volume's turned up, but that's essentially who they are because you can't keep it up that long.
Exactly. Yeah. You know, so, you see guys like that.
Yeah. It, for better or worse, it is who they are. You know. So, all right. Well, let's get back to the Strikeforce tournament. So. Sean Salmon, you know, we talked about you were supposed to fight Yuki Sasaki. Sasaki does not get cleared. Even though he weighed in, he actually didn't get cleared. He had a bad MRI reading, and so he ends up not being used. And so Sean Salmon is elevated from the alternate bout he was supposed to take on Dennis Hallman. So you find out you're going to be fighting Sean Salmon, who had been in the UFC earlier that year. Did you know anything about him as a fighter? Did you switch anything as far as it sounds like you didn't switch anything as far as your game plan because you were going to go for that flying knee and try to end things as quickly as possible. But did Sean Salmon present any sort of different obstacle, or was just full speed ahead? This is what we've trained for. This is what we're going to do.
No, I didn't change much. The only thing I changed was stopping blocking kicks that was doing the locker room. I know I'm glad I had Benji that day, man, with me that day, because we connected and he was like, man, he's a wrestler. That's all you need to know. So take your time to do your thing. If you see the opportunity, take it. And that was it, you know. And the same thing was the next one, you know. Then we won the first round, back to the locker room. My coaches said, look, you're fighting Trevor Prangley. Okay, he was undefeated by the time. And he told me, look, take your time. And that was my coach, my kickboxing coach, take your time. He's never been knocked out. I look at Benji again, and Benji, like, everybody has their first day. I was like, that's my man. I'm going with you. That was my night, I think.
Okay. Well, let's get back to the Salmon fight before we get to Prangley. But what ended up occurring was it was very effective, but a weird looking, really more of a flying shin to the neck. I mean, at first it looked like a knee, but on replay, it looked like the knee missed by like a millimeter, and then the shin connects to really more of his neck. And I remember Frank Shamrock on commentary was talking about like basically it's like his brain shut itself down to protect his body or something like that. But it was really weird looking and kind of, I don't know, like the way that Salmon responded to it, obviously, I mean, we'll get to it in just a second. You know, we ended up on a stretcher and all that stuff. But what do you remember about the end of that match? What do you remember about the knee? Did you feel like you connected with the knee? What do you think it was more of the shin? Like what's your take on that?
To be honest, I thought it was a knee after I watched the replay. I saw it was a shin. And he was standing still. I spin around when I land the knee, the flying knee. And I saw him going down, and I follow up with the punch, and right after I saw he was out already.
Yeah. But
honestly, I thought it was the knee. Then later I saw it was the shin, but it sucks. Like knee, you can't block it. You know, it's too much. There's no way of block. You can't block a kick, but a knee, everything it connects. It's too much power coming forward.
Yeah. Well, it was you know, spectacular regardless of how you looked at it. But as we said, Salmon ends up getting taken out on a stretcher. That's got to be a weird spot for a fighter. I mean, you just won in this amazing crowd pleasing way, and you know, big reaction, and for you know, Bigfoot's on the outside of the cage, excited and all that stuff. But then you're looking at your opponent, and he's in really bad shape, surrounded by doctors. He tries to get up and ends up, you know, going back down, and they have to take him out on a stretcher. Take us back to that moment. What did you feel? What do you remember thinking in the cage? As again, you're kind of celebrating, but at the same time, as a human being, you got to be worried about the guy you just knocked out.
No, I celebrated so much because I felt, man, I connected to flying knee, my first one, and this and that. And I looked at the guy, and time was taking more time for him to get up. I'm like, what the is going on? And I remember going to the backstage and even trying to see him. And they were like, no, you can't see him. He's already out. They brought him to the hospital. It was suck. You know, my striking coach was like, bro, he in the hospital, he's gonna be fine, you know, get back to the fight, we still have one more fight. Yeah. But it sucks, man. We don't want anybody to be have any consequence that take him away for what he's doing, he's leaving or he's in his life. We never know, man. It's a crazy sport. Right now, with 40 years old, I understand it more, and I'm like, I was so crazy. Why I did that? You know, I'm beyond blessed to be normal now, having my own business, having my kids. You know, because it's sad.
The things we do when we're 20, 25, and then you get older, and you're like, "What was I thinking?" Yeah. Well, after this, Prangley wins a controversial decision that was cut short by an accidental eye poke, and he had been kind of considered the favorite coming in. Obviously, you'd coming off UFC, you obviously had some notoriety within North America, but Prangley was the Bodog middleweight champion and all that. So you talked about you were aware of him. You definitely had kind of had him in your mind. Did you have a preference? Did you even spend any time thinking about between him and Falonico Vitale as far as who you would have rather fought between the two of them?
To be honest, no. I knew more about Trevor because, like I said, I got back to fight and Bulldog fight, and he was a champ of Bulldog fight on my weight division.
Right.
And I was like, if I get to fight Nico, I know I have a hard fight because I see this Hawaiian guy fighting forever.
Right.
And like, I know I'm going to have to fight two straight rounds, no matter what. Then I got the notice that I was fighting Prangley, and all of a sudden changed everything in my mind. Look, this is my opportunity. You know, I'm fighting for Bulldog fight. Actually, I brought in by Bulldog, not for Strike Force. So Bulldog was using my fights, my contract, to fight.
Oh,
yeah,
okay.
To fight into the Strike Force because they got together to do that.
Yeah, event. they had a promotional agreement, a partnership, basically.
Yeah. So like, man, okay. Like, you know what? What could be better than this? And now I'm fighting the title for the title. In my head, it was a title for Bulldog, and actually I got 2-1 because I wanted to fight the guy, and that night he made my day, you know, because I got a Strike Force, and because of that, they brought me to fight in Japan.
Okay, yeah, which you answered a question that I'm going to get to in just a second, but. So the Prangley fight goes a little bit longer, about 2.5 minutes. The Salmon fight was under 30 seconds. So it goes a little bit longer, but not a ton. It was your night. You weren't even really tested, and you end up finishing Prangley with a really solid right hand followed by a couple knees right up the middle, and that was all she wrote. So how did it feel to win the tournament and so convincingly? That's got to be a huge highlight for you.
It was the moment. In my career, that was one of the most special moments in my career. Of course, was that and winning the championship in Japan. But that when everything started, like, you know what? This is it, you know? I'm here to stay, you know? I was like, a couple months ago, I couldn't win. and I lost for these two guys in UFC, got knocked out, but I got my shit together. This is where I belong, and now from now on, I won't lose no more. And it was a really special moment, special night. I was very convinced that I was going to win. I didn't think it would be that easy, to be honest. Not saying my opponent was not tough. They were extremely tough, especially Trevor. Because if you asked me a couple months earlier, I would say, I don't know, I can win with that fight, because he's a full package. The guy's huge, big, from South Africa, and a great, crazy wrestler. He cuts weight. He's more like a 205 fighting 185.
Yep. Yeah, he's a big dude and very, very, very tough. So, and like you said, he was the champion of the organization that you were a part of. So that, you know, in some ways, it's got to be more satisfying to have beaten him rather than Vitaly, because he apparently was the guy in your division, in your company. So, but it was an amazing performance, very crowd pleasing. And you mentioned, you were fighting for the belt. Well, you did get a very nice looking belt from Strikeforce. I saw a picture of you with it. Do you still have that belt?
Yes, I do. It's in my house. My house is in my gym. It's here. I have a picture here. I can send the picture.
You send me a picture and I'll tweet it and post it on Instagram, because it's a nice looking belt. I felt kind of bad because Alistair Overeem won the heavyweight title that night, and he got kind of one of those old school kind of kickboxing looking belts. And then you get that really nice looking belt. I felt bad for Reem. I'm like, man, I would have been like, nah, I want the one Santiago got. Yeah, send me that picture. I would love to see that.
Yeah, listen, I hang it here together with my Japan in my gym in Kamaru Usman. Also, yeah, he also, we're hanging his belt here at the gym. I would send the picture for sure.
All right, well, so this is the question that you kind of answered, but Frank Shamrock, he's on commentary. He's the middleweight champion at that time. Very impressed by you, and, you know, kind of made a comment about, you know, man, I guess I got a new contender to deal with. I wanted to ask why you didn't stay with Strikeforce. This was your only time in Strikeforce, but it sounds like you were fulfilling Bodog fights on your contract, and then I assume that ran out, and you went to Sengoku after that?
Yeah, the fight... We offered Bulldog and my manager tried to make that fight. Shamrock didn't want to make this fight.
Okay.
So, yeah, it was sort of Alan Goyce. I don't know if you know him, but...
Yeah, Pride veteran, yeah.
Yeah, totally. Yeah. He was trying to fight also in the organization because he's from California, too. He has some beef against Shamrock.
It seemed like everybody from California had some sort of beef against Frank.
Yeah, so Frank didn't want any business with me, and... And because I was supposed to fight the Japanese dude, Yuki Sasaki.
That's irony is that you end up fighting him in your next fight, which we'll get to in just a second. But that's the irony of this is you end up not facing him in the tournament, but then he's your next fight after this night.
Yeah. So never happened. Shamrock denied the fight. He didn't want to fight, and we gave him a couple months. I mean, a couple weeks actually, because then. The Japanese organization just asked for a fight, you know, because there was a time Pride finished.
Yep, Pride was done at this point.
Yeah, Pride was done on that point, and they had two events, and they split on K1 Heroes.
Yeah, there was one called like Yarinoka or something like that. And they were kind of we had a few different promotions that tried to take the place of Pride in Japan.
Yeah, so it was that one, Heroes, and Sengoku.
Right.
So they were doing the first event, and they want to see that fight. And I was like, yeah, that's... I started the fight because I wanted to be in Japan, so that's my opportunity. So yeah. I didn't want to talk anymore about, I mean, with the Strikeforce. I'm like, okay, I'm the contender. If they want me to fight, I'm sure.
Yeah, they have your number if they want you to fight, so... All right. Well, you had a very successful run in Sengoku. I mean, that's, you know, as great as the one night tournament in Strikeforce was, you know, if you're going to be remembered for anything, it's got to be that run in Sengoku. You won, I think it was like 9 of your next 10 fights. And the only fight you lost there, you actually got from Mehmed Khalidov, you got revenge in your very next fight after that. So, you know, you win there. their middleweight title. You also won a one-night middleweight tournament for them as well. So maybe you're the king of the one-night middleweight tournaments. Then after retiring, you go on, you coach, you mentioned the Black Zillions, which was run by Glenn Robinson, who you don't know this, but Glenn, I actually worked for Glenn for a while. Part of his management. Yeah, I was as part of his management company, Authentic. I think it was Authentic Sports Management. I did PR for them for a while. And he was a really good guy. Really, you know, he had made his money off the Iron Tool Bridge Iron Bridge Tools. Yeah. And so I know that was kind of all married together. And, you know, obviously may he rest in peace, and very sad that we lost him a couple years ago unexpectedly. But, you know, you end up with a very successful career. You got your own gym now. So tell us kind of what you've got going on, what fighters you're working with, and, you know, plug whatever you want. Social media, just let the listeners know what you got going on right now.
Yeah, but basically 2015, unfortunately, the gym Black Zillion was done. I decided to go myself back to jiu-jitsu community. That was something that I missed when I have to start fighting jiu-jitsu, MMA. So now I opened my gym in 2016. I'm here in Boynton Beach, Florida. We call Excel Jiu-Jitsu. You can find us online, excelbjj.com. So far, it's been we're going for the fifth year. We're successful. We're here to stay. Right now, as a coach, I'm just working with Kamaru Usman and Tyler Ray. He fights in RFA.
Okay.
Yeah. So as far as professional fighters, that's the only thing I'm doing right now. But I'm very busy with my gym, and I'm glad that I done what I did in my life, but now I'm just on a different page now.
Okay. Awesome. Well, I got one more question I want to ask, and then we'll let you go. Looking back, you know, with all the accomplishments, making it, you know, having two separate runs in the UFC, you it sounded like your dream was to get to Japan, and you fought in Sengoku very, very successfully. Where does the Strikeforce tournament win rank amongst the biggest moments in your career?
I was just, was a starting point. That was my reborn. That's when I started. Everything else we had before, I was just a kid, you know, going with the flow. But that was the most important accomplishment that I had. I mean, together with the Sengoku champ, but that's when I count as a professional fighter and retire as a fighter when I won the Sengoku championship. You know, that was the most important thing. And that's how I finished too. Cause when I got back from Japan to UFC, I didn't want to fight at all. I wasn't even trained, so I didn't give a shit. I hate UFC.
Well, I appreciate that. That makes a lot of sense. And yeah, your rebirth with that tournament win, it, you know, launches you into the stratosphere, so to speak. And appreciate your accomplishments within the sport. But George, you're a busy man, but I appreciate you taking the time to join us on Inside the Hexagon, giving us this great insight. And yeah, best of luck. And don't forget to send me that picture.
For sure, man. For sure. I will send it right now. Thank you. Thank you so much, Phil. Thanks for your time, too. It was a pleasure talking to you.
All right, I want to thank my very special guest, George Santiago, for joining us for today's episode. I really enjoyed connecting with him. I've never spoken with him before, so it was great to kind of get to know him, and I look forward to maybe doing more with him in the future. But very interesting guy. I hope that you enjoyed that conversation. And he did send me the photos of his Strikeforce belt. He also sent one of his Sengoku belt, as well as a photo that's got his Strikeforce title and one of Kamaru Usman's titles, one of his UFC welterweight belts as well. So make sure you follow us on Twitter at Hexagon Pod and on Instagram at Inside the Hexagon Pod. You can check us out on both those, and I will post those photos this week. But really, really good stuff. Hope that you enjoyed that. Coming up, we are going to be checking out Strikeforce at the Dome. This is headlines by Bob the Beast Sapp versus Jan the Giant Norte. There's an appearance by George Masvidal, but beyond that, not a whole lot of recognizable names on that card. Maurice Smith, the former UFC heavyweight champion, makes his return to MMA. So we discuss all of that. Not a great card overall, but very, very interesting. Me and Josh really have fun kind of delving into the ugly part of putting events together, and sometimes what results come from that. get into Bob the Beast Sapp a lot. So there's a lot of interesting stuff on there. So make sure that you subscribe and check us out on that. After that, we're going to be going into a great conversation with Gorgeous George Garcia of MMA Junkie Radio. We talk about Strikeforce's talent influence on the UFC and Bellator. Some really cool stories shared by George during that episode. So that's going to be a really good one. After that, we're going to get into Strikeforce Shamrock versus Lee, one of the pivotal events in the early part of Strikeforce's history. Definitely going to be worth checking out. And then the week after that, we talk with the man himself, Kung Lee. So that's going to be a great conversation as well. So lots of really good stuff coming up. May have a bonus episode coming up soon as well. So make sure again that you subscribe to us wherever you get your podcast, but we appreciate the support. Hope that you've taken the time to rate and review us. If not, please do so on however you listen to us, especially Apple Podcasts. Helps others find the show, but we would really appreciate anything you can do on that front. Let your friends know. Anybody that's interested in MMA should be interested in this show, I would hope. So make sure that you share and let people know about it. But with that, we're going to go ahead and ride off into the sunset. Again, we appreciate all the support. Hope that you stay safe and you stay healthy. We will see you soon.
Hey there, my name is Michael Laminato, and this is Pit Pass F1, a brand new podcast that'll take you closer to the action of the world's most prestigious motorsport. From Monaco to Miami and Australia to Azerbaijan, Pit Pass F1 is on the ground and has you covered. Esteemed F1 journalists Julianne Serasoli and Chris Medland will take you inside the sport every round. They'll keep you up to date with the latest news breaking in Formula One and the most influential views shaping the world of Grand Prix racing. Every Friday, we'll be bringing you a track guide and race preview, and Chris and Drew will be in your feed every morning from Saturday through to Monday to keep you up to date on all the day's action on and off the track. So if you want to be in the know on the latest in Formula One, subscribe wherever you get your favourite podcasts and visit us at evergreenpodcasts.com. Pit Pass F1, a brand new show for Evergreen Podcasts.